We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons, broadcasting live from Studio C. Today we have the pleasure of having a conversation about this nation's small-town newspapers and larger questions about print journalism with Judy Muller, the author of Emus, Loose, and Egnar, Big Stories from Small Towns, and a familiar voice to these airwaves. The book is beautifully published by University of Nebraska Press. Judy Muller is an Emmy Award-winning television correspondent and National Public Radio commentator and a faculty member of the USC Annenberg School for Communication. Muller went to work for ABC News in 1990, covered the 1992 Rodney King trial and ensuing riots, the 1994 Northridge earthquake, and the O.J. Simpson criminal and civil trials, among many other stories. As part of the Nightline team, she received an Alfred DuPont Columbia University Award for coverage of the 1992 Los Angeles riots and an Emmy Award for coverage of the Simpson case. A regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition, she also wrote a book about her experiences as a journalist titled Now This, Radio, Television, and the Real World. Our guest is also a contributing correspondent to California Connected, a topical magazine broadcast that airs on public television stations throughout California. Before joining the ABC News team, Muller was a CBS News correspondent who contributed to CBS News Sunday Report and the CBS Weekend News. She's a graduate of Mary Washington College, I believe that's in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and has received numerous journalism honors, including the New Jersey Broadcasters Association Award and the American Bar Association Award and the Colorado Sigma Delta Chi Award. She resides in Los Angeles, California, and in Norwood, Colorado, elevation 7,062 feet. No surprise that she prefers Norwood, and who wouldn't? Take it from this often absent former Fort Lewis College student in Durango that she's on the right side of that preference. Regarding her new book, Emus, Loose, and Egnar, the magazine Maclean's writes, with big city papers under serious threat from the internet and social media, Muller argues print journalism is alive and kicking in small towns across America. The most delightful moments of the book, the magazine continues, come from the ways local papers reveal small-town life in all its claustrophobic glory. From Nebraska's Chadron Record police blotter comes this, caller advised her neighbor has two chihuahuas and he's outside putting in an electric fence. That's going to be too much for those little dogs. And caller advised that the batteries in her blood pressure machine are not working and is requesting an officer come over and change them for her. Kirkus Reviews wrote that the book is told with deep affection and respect, a thoroughly engaging journey down journalism's blue highways, end quote. Did everyone catch the William Least Heat Moon reference there? To join our discussion locally, call 333-9455, or if you're out of the area, toll free at 800-222-9455. To give a flavor of the book, Emus, Loose, and Egnar, let me read a brief section from the prologue. This book is about a different kind of bottom line, one that lives in the hearts of weekly newspaper editors and reporters who keep churning out news for the corniest of reasons, the belief that our freedoms depend on it. Not that they would necessarily express it that way. As the editor of the paper in Dove Creek, Colorado put it, if we found a political official misusing taxpayer funds, we wouldn't hesitate to nail him to a stump. You can find these brave people in the newsrooms of small towns all across America. I know, because I spent more than a year tracking some of them down, and what I discovered was that many small-town papers are thriving, mostly because absolutely no one else does what they do, document the births, deaths, crimes, sports, local shenanigans, and many other events that only matter to a 2,000 or so souls in their circulation area. Taken together, however, these little stories create a mosaic of American life that tells us a great deal about who we are, what moves us, angers us, amuses us. As a weekly editor in Alaska said, quote, I feel as though I'm writing the great American novel, one week at a time, end quote. Judy Muller, welcome to Focus 580.
That's wonderful that you, what an introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, you wrote it.
Yes, not well.
Well, I mean, you wrote the prologue, excuse me. We do have some journalism integrity here. What was the tipping point for your motivation to write this fascinating book?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember. I get asked that a lot. And I think what it was, you know, I teach here at USC. And for years now, I mean, I thought if I sat on one more panel discussion, is journalism dead? As the title, you mm-hmm. know, I was going to kill somebody. I mean, it just, first of all, I don't believe that. I think we're going through a great revolution, an amazing time. It's just the upheaval is painful, but we can get back to that in a minute. But I really was curious about what was going on in weeklies, because I started at a weekly in New Jersey, and it's where I really got bitten by the journalism bug. I loved it. We didn't get paid much, but, you know, we were important to that community, and I learned to love the craft there. So I was talking to a friend who wrote for Time magazine. We were hiking, and I telling her this idea. I said, you know, I wonder if I should go out and just see what's happening, and maybe there's a book in it. And she said, you need to write that book. It was all I needed, was just that shove. And so I headed out and started my quest. It took about a year to track down all the ones I needed, and, of course, there's many more I could have done. And then the University of Nebraska Press was interested. They liked the idea and bought it, and there you go. But there were days when I'd be out there in a motel in some godforsaken part of God knows where, ready to interview somebody, thinking, what am I doing out here? Who's going to read this? You know. But it turns out a lot of people are interested in this.
Well, I think your book, following up on what you just said, is counterintuitive to what we presently believe is the fate of traditional newspaper journalism, that it's dying out, or if it does exist, it's mainly celebrity-driven, concerned with Lady Gaga's wardrobe or Brad and Angelina's latest adoption of a third world child. Yeah. And as you point out, there's some 8,000 weeklies in the U.S., and I guess we should clarify that you're not necessarily writing about the free alternative weeklies like the Chicago Reader.
No, I'm not.
Or the checkout stand tabloids like World Weekly News.
Which is also, by the way, one of my favorite things ever. I mean, you know, my favorite headline in World Weekly News was, half girl, half boy gets self pregnant. But that's another story altogether.
Do you have a link to that?
No, I saved it, though. No. These are papers that really serve small towns. I wanted to kind of concentrate on the smaller communities, because that, you know, there's a new buzzword in our profession, hyper-local. Even the big dailies are saying we have to do more hyper-local news, meaning neighborhood by neighborhood kind of thing. Well, these papers were hyper-local before the term was invented. They have a captive audience. You can't get that news anywhere else. So if you want to know what's happening in your community, that's the place you go. If you want to advertise to those people, that's the place you go. And so far, things like Craigslist, which have so undermined classified ads in big cities, haven't really made inroads into some of these rural communities. Facebook's hurting a little bit, but it's still not as trustworthy in some towns as an editor who has some credibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, I live in a small town in central Illinois with a weekly that I would not in any way describe as a crusader type of weekly, and we'll get into that in a minute. It would definitely fall on the side of boosterism. In fact, anyone who tried to practice hard-hitting crusader-style journalism in this town, I think, would find it tough going.
Uh-huh.
Yet there's a certain charm to reading about the quote, citywide trick-or-treat for hunger food drive, or that
right.
The senior art students are making homecoming magic. And I love reading court news. You know, who
right.
got picked up and fined for what, you know, guilty and proven until proven otherwise. It's also a nice respite, I think, from the usual nonstop news bladder that assaults us 24/7. And in tough economic times, how are these weeklies surviving?
Well, as I said, they do have advertisers who are loyal, because you really can't reach that audience in a better way than your town paper. And the legal advertising is very big to these groups. I know there's a push among some governments to try to get their legal ads online, which would be free. And the papers, of course, are fighting that, because it's, you know, they need that money. So that's going on. But that's really where they get their money. And they operate on a very tight budget. Usually there's an editor, maybe one or two more reporters. In some cases, I found in New Mexico, there's a wonderful paper called the Rio Grande Sun, which has six full-time reporters, and they really believe in covering the county. But it's small. They don't waste any money. And, you know, this is something, of course, that the big dailies are learning. You know, we can't afford everything. But the small papers have known it forever.
We're speaking with Judy Mahler, the author of Emus, Loose, and Egnar, Big Stories from Small Towns. To join our conversation locally, dial 333-9455. Out of the area, 800-222-9455. Judy, I was fascinated by another movement afoot that I did not realize, that many of the reporters and editors that you wrote about or that have been laid off in big city dailies, such as one of my favorites when I lived in Colorado, the Rocky Mountain News, have ended up working for weeklies, or in the case of the Guadalupe County Communicator, end up becoming publisher. Can you talk about this?
Yes. The Rocky Mountain News folded a few years ago, as you know. And this is happening to major dailies in a number of cities, Seattle, Denver. And when it folded, one of their reporters, their national correspondent based in Washington, Emmy Springlemeyer, decided that he was going to go out and, as he says, kick the tires of a few weeklies around the country to see if he might be interested in buying one, be the publisher, be the editor. And he found this paper in Guadalupe County, Santa Rosa, New Mexico. And he bought it, and he's been there. I think he just finished his first year, and he bought it. He brought along the photographer from the Rocky, Mark Holm. He brought along a political cartoonist. They all moved there. It's a wonderful little town right on Route 66, and he turned this paper into something. I mean, it's so amazing. I of course, subscribe to this and many papers now, keeping up with the Lions there and how their team's doing. But the photography is astonishing. The writing is just so wonderful. And I don't think this town knew what hit it. I mean, wow. And he's enjoying it. He's tired. You know, it's a lot of work. But he says he's never felt so gratified. He sits in his office and people just stream through the door all day with ideas and comments. And it's a much more intimate kind of journalism than you get, you know, being a national correspondent for the Rocky Mountain News.
Now, on the extreme end of that, of big city journalist comes to small country town, I'm thinking of your chapter on editor Michael Dillon in the Corn County News. Now, you set the scene by describing Mr. Dillon as a veteran print and TV journalist from Jacksonville, Florida, who saw an ad for the editor position and thought it'd be kind of nice to wrap up his career with a quiet job in a beautiful place where he could write stories about little old ladies planting gardens. What happened to Mr. Dillon?
Poor Mike walked into the propeller blade of we don't cotton to strangers asking tough questions around here. You
know? Which is a very Western, I mean, that's a cultural thing in the West, I believe.
But especially in Hardin, Montana. I have to say, I wandered into this place. I picked it because it had competing newspapers, I mean, three of them in a 25-square-mile area. And I wanted to look at that phenomenon and how they all survive. And it's a very Rashomon kind of approach to journalism because you have to sort of read all three to get the whole story. But one is sort of what I'd call the mainstream white paper in Chamber of Commerce kind of paper in Hardin. Then there's something called the Daily Briefs, which in keeping with that second word, has a picture of jockey shorts on the masthead. and then there's the Indian Reservation, the Crow paper, the tribal paper, which is very close by. And it really is something. Mike Dillon was hired there. He's a very good writer. He came in, but he had all of these ethics, like I don't join the Chamber of Commerce because I'm a journalist. You know, he came in with these sort of big city ethical attitudes and didn't want to get close to anybody. And then he did what any good journalist would do. He looked at the story in town, which was that they had funded a $21 million bond to build a detention center there, thinking, because their consultant told them, you know, basically, if you build it, they will come, the prisoners, that is. Well, they didn't, and they didn't have a contract to bring in prisoners, and that building is still sitting empty today. But when Mike was there, he looked at it and said, holy, you know, what... you know, any idiot can see that that's a heck of a story. You don't build a stadium without a team. And he went after that story, which was not a popular thing to do with the mainstream folks in Hardin. So he lasted 3 months. Mm. In fact, he was fired the week I was there, which was quite stunning.
Well, I remember you describe a scene where you walk into the newspaper office and you compliment him
yeah, I compliment
on his story.
Him on the story, and the whole place goes silent, and he turns red, and he said, thank you, I needed that today. And I'm going, what is going on in this room? It was quite a journey.
So these traditional journalistic ethics of not joining different organizations, do they just not apply, or do you have to be flexible when you show up in a small town?
You have to be a little more flexible. Mm-hmm. You live next door to the people you're writing about. Sometimes you're related to them. And the best example I can think of somebody who walks that line so brilliantly is Lori Ezell Brown in the panhandle of Texas in a little town called Canadian, Texas. It's on the Canadian River, hence its name. And she's a second-generation family member who runs that paper. And her family won the Courage in Journalism Award from the University of Kentucky. They have an award they give out every year for a rural journalist who displays outstanding courage in the face of pressure. And Lori's had windows shot out of her car. She's been bullied. She's been sued. And she is, interestingly enough, a Democrat in a fairly conservative oil and gas Republican place, but highly respected because she is so very fair. And she doesn't give favors to anybody. When her brother, who was the superintendent of the local county hospital, was violating open public meeting laws, sunshine laws, and not letting the press into certain meetings, she warned him. She says, if you don't open these meetings up to me, the press, I am going to report that you're in violation of the law. And she ended up having to do that, and he didn't speak to her for a year. Now, that's taking a stand in the interest of your readers.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Crusaders for a moment. You have a chapter devoted to that, and we'll get to the Journalism Award, which has an incredible history attached to it. The Wall Street Journal, when it, which changed hands not too long ago and surprisingly added a book review section, stated about your book that, quote, these rural journalists' devotion to truth-telling keeps the First Amendment live and communities connected in grassroots America, end quote. And you have some great examples of courageous truth-tellers, and I wonder if you could tell our listeners about Tom Gish and the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky, which is really not that far from where I'm talking to you.
Right. Tom and Pat Gish really stand out in this way. And in the 50s, they bought the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and at the time I think the slogan was something vapid like, a nice country weekly that prints every week. I mean, it was like some horrible slogan.
A little redundant.
Yeah, and they changed it to the Mountain Eagle. It screams. Mm. And indeed it did. And for the next years, they took on bullies wherever they saw them, and the coal companies were often in violation of safety standards. And, the poverty in the area was so outrageous in Appalachia. And many credit the Gishes and the Mountain Eagle with starting Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, that it was because of their reporting that the New York Times noticed it. They came down. They thought, oh, well, they're probably exaggerating this. Found out they'd actually underestimated the problem. That got the attention of the White House, and pretty soon, everybody's coming down there to report on the conditions in Appalachia, which were horrendous at the time, and it all came from the Gishes. And they really, they had to stand up to some terrible stuff. Their son, Ben Gish, is now running the paper. Tom Gish has died a couple years ago, and Pat has Alzheimer's. So Ben, their son, is running it. And I interviewed him for the book, and he was telling me when he was a teenager, his parents were out of town, and they got a call. They didn't get a call. They heard the fire siren in town, which, like good little journalist kids in the family, they called up and said, where's the fire? And they said, it's your office. Mm. It's the newspaper office. And they ran down, and the newspaper, their family's newspaper, burned to the ground. And their parents were out of town. They tried frantically to get hold of them. And what happened was that that it later turned out that somebody, they believe the coal company, had hired someone, and it turned out to be a cop in town, a police officer, to torch the place because of what they'd been writing. And by the way, just to give you an idea of the atmosphere there, that officer was given a slap on the wrist and time off for whatever, good behavior. Never served any time for that arson. In fact, he ran for public office later, and he had a vanity plate on his car that said Eagle Burner on it. And he handed out matchbooks with his name on it running for office. This gives you an idea of what you're up against in a town like that. But the Mountain Eagle, this is my favorite part of the story. The parents came running home, and they got all the kids, and they borrowed typewriters, they put them up in the house, and they typed out the next week's edition of the Mountain Eagle. They were determined to get it out on the streets. And the slogan that week, and that week only, was, "The Mountain Eagle, it still screams." And it's so, Charles Kuralt came down, and back in the day when Charles Kuralt was on the road and doing things for CBS News, and this was even shot in film, I actually saw it, amazing piece about the Gish family. And that was such a wonderful, you can imagine the sound of Charles Kuralt talking about, I'm just trying to find it, here it is. He says, he's standing in front of the old printing press at the Gish's office, and you hear Kuralt say, "It is what is known as freedom of the press, that one man with a typewriter and an offset printing machine may take on any giant." And I, you know, it gives me tingles now.
Yes.
That's what we got to get back to. And I think these people represent that very grassroots, hardcore First Amendment kind of journalism.
We're speaking with Judy Muller, the author of Emus, Loose, and Egnar. My name is Stephen Lyons. You're listening to Focus 580 on WILL. And also, I'm looking in that same section, and when Tom Gish was asked by Charles Kuralt why he insisted on staying, he chuckled and said, Tom Gish did, "That would amount to a kind of surrendering that I just can't do."
Yeah. It wouldn't have occurred to him to do anything else. I think when he was dying, his good friend was sitting there with him and saying, I guess my question is, did we make a difference? And Gish said, well, what was the alternative? I mean, it wasn't a matter of whether you made a difference. I mean, there's still poverty in Appalachia. We know that. There's still coal mine disasters in Appalachia. But there was no alternative for him. You had to speak the truth to these people. Nobody else would do it, give a voice to the voiceless, in that corny old journalism phrase we have, you know, give a voice to the voiceless. And something I try to drum into my students. This isn't about getting on television. This isn't about being the next Anderson Cooper, although he's very good. You know, this is about giving a voice to the voiceless. And the first time your story makes a difference and changes something, you will understand.
Let's take a call from Coles County. Caller, you're talking with Judy Muller.
Yes, I wanted to mention that I get a little upset every time I hear the so-called experts in New York and so forth talk about the crisis of American newspapers, but that does exist, of course, but they never seem to take account of weekly newspapers and twice-a-week newspapers, and there are so very many of them, and as you have mentioned, many of them do an excellent job, and their cumulative circulation is enormous. I don't know what the number is, but it's the cumulative circulation of weeklies and twice a week is very great, and they don't seem to take that into account and take into account the fact that most of these papers are doing very well, thank you. Most of them are maintaining circulation pretty well and doing reasonably good in advertising. So sometimes when I hear on the radio or TV someone talking about crisis of newspapers, I like to scream at them and say that they ought to at least take into account the fact that weekly newspapers are doing pretty darn good out there.
Well, it's interesting. I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
And it was because of that frustration I wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times about exactly what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been reprinted in every major daily.
Really?
I would say, yes. It's still being, I'm still getting requests every day.
Oh,
could
really?
We reprint this? And a lot of weekly, you know, papers are asking because you just
yes.
said, you've just spoken for us. And what shocked me about this book, I mean, I really wrote it just kind of out of the love of small towns and small papers. I didn't expect to have a, you know, any kind of impact in terms of policy. But what's amazing to me is that nobody has spoken up for this aggregate group before in this way, unless, you know, the Institute of Rural Journalism in University of Kentucky does it, but in a way that touches people to this extent. And I think it's wonderful that finally we can have a showcase for these papers, which are so busy doing the work that they never have time to get together and blow their own horn. Mm-hmm. These people are the busiest journalists
yeah.
on the planet.
Yeah, they
don't
work
take
hard.
A day off.
Yeah.
Thank you, caller, very
okay,
much.
Yeah.
That was
right.
a very good call.
Yeah.
We're talking to Judy Mahler, author of Emus, Loose, and Egnar. Our phone number to join the conversation locally is 333-9455, out of the area, 800-222-9455. Now we're going to take a brief break.
On the next Fresh Air, see Peter Wagner, a leading apostle in the new Apostolic Reformation. Its missions include dominion, taking leadership positions in government, education, business, and the media, and evangelizing cities by conducting spiritual warfare against demons. Several apostles affiliated with the movement helped organize or spoke at Rick Perry's prayer rally. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
We're back with Judy Mahler, author of Emus, Loose, and Egnar, published by University of Nebraska Press, and I must say beautifully published. They do wonderful work at University of Nebraska Press. Our phone number to join the conversation, locally 333-9455. Out of the area to 1-800 or just 800-222-9455. Judy, it's an easy segue into curmudgeons, another chapter in your book, who you define as simply crusaders with a whole lot of attitude. And this includes characters like 70-year-old Bruce Anderson, who's the owner and editor of the Anderson Valley Advertiser in Mendocino County, California. And on the front page of that weekly, you report that the motto is fanning the flame of discontent. And they have a quote from Joseph
yes.
Pulitzer, newspapers should have no friends. Tell our listeners about Mr. Anderson. And is he an effective newspaper man? And what does he contribute to American journalism?
Ben Anderson is my favorite. I have to say, I'm just going to say it. He's my favorite out of all these people. I just find him, he's a curmudgeon in the most honorable sense of the word. And I think that it's not the kind of journalism I would be teaching here at USC because he's not always real dedicated to, what would we call it, objectivity?
Would this be advocacy journalism?
Yes, it is advocacy journalism. That's kind of a new phrase, but that's exactly what he is. He's a muckraker. And the muckrakers, if anybody knows their history in this country, were actually very, very brave people who you know, did give a voice to the voiceless. And who was it that told me? Alexander Coburn, who is himself something of a polemicist, said of Anderson, he's up there with the best of Thomas Paine, Mark Twain, and H.L. Mencken.
Not bad.
And I agree with that. I think he's an amazing writer. He's almost Dickensian in the way he finds these villains in a small place. He lives in Boonville in the Anderson Valley. It's not named after his family, but up in Mendocino County, which is sort of what he calls the intoxicant capital of the world between marijuana and wine. You pretty much have it covered. And but he really does take on those big wine growers who are like polluting water. Or he refers to the rich people who live up in the ridge lines in their big mansions as hill muffins and the golden horde. But he also doesn't discriminate. I mean, he takes on environmentalists and calls them the rural fascist league and self-appointed righteous ones and lotus-eating lazy mystics. I mean, you know, he just doesn't spare anybody.
Do you think he's effective?
I think he's very effective.
For his audience, I guess.
He's gotten things changed. Mm-hmm. They really, some of the officials just get so annoyed with him. But, in fact, he was covering a school board meeting, and I think it was the superintendent. He'd written something about came over to him in a very aggressive manner, and Bruce thought that he was going to take a swing at him. And so Bruce got in the first swing, and he was arrested for assault, and he went to jail. And he said it was really great because in the jail he discovered these terrible conditions. so he wrote about that, and the county had to build a new jail based on what he documented while he was in jail. So he's always looking, you know.
Immersion journalism at its finest.
Immersion journalism, yeah.
Then there's Moab, Utah's Jim Stiles, who's publisher of the Canyon County Zephyr, and one of those people when I lived out west. I mean, I was one of these people who moves to the west and then declares it off limits to newcomers, similar to his hero, Pennsylvania native, the late Ed Abbey, and just right. About everyone in Telluride has that same attitude, I think. You can tell your folks there in Telluride.
Yeah, when they build their 10,000-foot log home.
Right. When I lived in the area, it was still boarded up, but it was sort of coming to life, and you knew it was doomed because it was too beautiful.
Yeah.
Anyway, Abby, who was a classic curmudgeon and also a classic entertainer, sent a lot of us Midwesterners out west, bless his heart. And I understand Stiles has finally even riled up the environmental community that he was definitely a part of. What happened there?
Well, Jim took on, he'd been taking on all the ranchers who didn't graze their cows properly and were wrecking the rivers. That, I mean, all of that was the old, you know, the miners, the uranium miners. That was standard. And, of course, all the environmentalists loved him for that. And he had a huge readership of people, the Abbey addicts and disciples who would come out and just, you know, loved the West for the way it was. But then he realized that some of these major environmental groups, not the Sierra Club, but some others, had people at the heads of them who were building these mega mansions, or McMansions as we call them, up in the mountains. And, the carbon footprints he found intolerable, and he thought the hypocrisy needed to be addressed. And so he addressed it. And what happened then was that he lost a lot of his base, and he was vilified on both sides at that point. Jim's paper is now online only, and he's finding that rather liberating, which I think is funny for a man whose slogan is clinging hopelessly to the past, that he now enjoys such freedom as an online journalist because it's cheaper to publish, of course, and he's having more fun with color and slideshows and things like that are all the gifts of digital journalism. But he's still taking on all those foes wherever he sees them. I think Jim is really kind of, and he would admit, anachronistic. I mean, you can't close off the West to people who love it. And even too many campers, he thinks, violates the code. So that's pretty extreme position.
Well, the transformation in Moab has been spectacular.
Yeah.
And not all to the good either. But I remember in the early 70s, it was just uranium miners and 3.2 beer. And when we showed up with our long hair, we weren't exactly welcome. But it's a whole different place now of Lycra and bike riders and, you know, you've seen it, you know it.
So. I've seen it and I know it, and yet I can still drive through Moab and find it lovely. I mean, you know, it's all relative. Wasn't there in the 60s.
The rocks haven't changed.
I was in Telluride in the 60s. My brother moved there in the 60s. Mm-hmm. There was no ski resort yet. Mm-hmm. The roads weren't paved. And it was lovely, and now it's a major resort. It's still lovely. It just depends on, you know, what you're looking for.
Well, I miss Edward Abbey a lot. you have a chapter titled Too Close for Comfort, the idea that in the words of Lake Wobegon's fictitious newspaper editor Harold Starr, the first principle of journalism is, I have to live here too, you know. You discuss some real life examples of when small town editors face social isolation, the shunning by their friends and neighbors. Can you discuss this peril?
Yeah, I love the Herald Star reference. So many editors would bring that up as sort of their hero. Herald Star is the editor of the Herald Star in Like Woe Be Gone. And yes, I have to live here too, you know. And that's the reality. It's much tougher to expose corruption if the corrupt official is the best friend of your father, you know, something like that. You have to be there, and I've talked to a number of editors or reporters in this book who would find themselves standing in the checkout line at the IGA or the grocery store of the town and having people not talk to them, not even having the cashier talk to them, icing them out. And when you're shunned in a small town, that is a lonely place. That's why a lot of the people who stay and do this for any kind of time are often married couples who do the paper together. I found that was often true. Or families that could bolster each other when somebody turned against them. Sometimes it would result in an advertiser threatening to remove their advertising. And if it's one of your major advertisers, you know, you think about that. And to the credit of many of these people, not all of them, and you were talking about your hometown paper, that's kind of a chamber of commerce booster,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of them in that crucible of telling the truth versus going along to getting along, for getting along, many of them choose what I would call the right side. And I think that is incredibly brave. I think to do it week after week, no matter what, is incredibly brave. And in the end, they get the respect of their public and they get the respect of their advertisers. And because it's kind of a captive audience and captive advertising base, they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of couples that run papers, you talk about the Dove Creek Press. And when I was down there, Dove Creek used to be the soybean or the pinto bean capital of the world.
It still is.
It still is. Okay. There was a sign there. I remember seeing that. But
that's right.
This particular newspaper likes to accentuate the positive. So this is not a paper that will be up for the Tom Gish Award anytime soon. But who are Doug and Linda Funk?
Doug and Linda Funk are a married couple who bought up this paper. They admit they have no journalism background. They just wanted it. They thought it'd be fun. They have a print shop in the front, which is, you know, probably where they make most of their money. But they also take it very seriously. And they feel that they should err on the side of being the glue of the community. And so they're not going to probably do a lot of exposés, but then there's not a lot going on in Dove Creek anyway. And I think that, well, the reason I found them was I picked up the paper on the way through town one day, and it was the most unintentionally hilarious lead story I've ever seen about this car accident. And a local boy was driving, and his passenger, his girlfriend, was thrown out of the car, bounced off a roof, came down, and looks like she'd be paralyzed for life. But that doesn't get mentioned until the very end of the story on the jump page, and at that point they say, the doctors say she has a 1% chance of living again, and everybody is praying for that 1% chance. I mean, this is classic funkism, optimism,
wow.
You know, that they would spin it that way. And the boy who was driving the car, and it's absolutely hysterical the way it unrolls this story. Each paragraph adds another layer of, oh, and by the way, he had a brain tumor and probably shouldn't have been driving. But the doctor said only unless he was under stress should he not drive. Well, that morning he'd run over his dog, and that was stressful.
about burying the lead. I mean, they really buried it.
Hysterical, yeah. So that's how I found the Funks. And then I just really liked the Funks a lot. I just thought, you know, they do the best with what they've got, and they're sincere and they're honest, and that's maybe all you can ask for. By the way, the title of the book, Emus, Luce and Egnar, comes from their police blotter, a local rancher in the town of Egnar, which is range spelled backwards. Mm-hmm. They wanted range, but it was taken, so they spelled it backwards.
And listeners, you can hold up the title of the book to a mirror, and you can see that it will say, indeed, range, but the emus gets messed up.
Yeah.
as I said earlier, I love reading my local newspaper. The first thing I turn to is the police blotters.
Yep, everybody
does. My goodness, it's just wonderful. And again, it's guilty until proven innocent. That's another conversation for another time. You have an entire chapter devoted to police blotters, and some of them are just so wonderful. I don't know if I'd say hilarious, but just odd. You know, here's one from Nebraska, chapter in Nebraska, 3:07 p.m. RP stayed at his ex-neighbor, drove by and flipped him off in the 200 block of North Mears. 6:52 p.m., RP advised her neighbors in the 300 block of Pinecrest Drive were, quote, wrecking my state of mind. A Boonville resident said his neighbor was dangerously nuts. The Boonville resident said that his dangerously nuts neighbor was now yelling at him and throwing rocks at his house. Can you talk about these? These are just colorful, wonderful glimpses of small-town America.
And what I love is that the best ones to me are the ones that are just reprinted in the sort of dispassionate language of the dispatcher at the sheriff's office, who just takes them in. So RP is reporting party called to say, man reports wife went missing 3 months ago. That's one of my favorites. You know, really? Just got around to noticing that, did you?
Well, the dishes stacked up, perhaps, in his house. So, who knows?
Nobody's bringing him any more beer. I mean,
right.
What was that? So it's really quite wonderful to read between the lines of this stuff, which isn't hard to do. You know, you can imagine one, I think it was in Chadron again, where somebody said, reporting party called to say that neighbor had 8-year-old son mowing the lawn, which didn't seem right since she was perfectly capable of doing it herself. You know.
And reporting party requested assistance in the 300 block of West 10th in getting his overweight dog up
the
basement stairs.
Right. Yes. Oh, pets and dogs and stuck squirrels in the fireplace. I mean, can you imagine? I live in Los Angeles. Imagine a call like that coming into the South LA Police Department. I mean, they would just laugh. Or the woman who wants the battery changed. You read that one at the top.
Right.
You know, that woman, everybody knew in Nebraska, was alone and very lonely, and the police knew that. And so when she'd call and say, could somebody help me with something so simple, they would go over what they could, because what they knew she really needed was to see that somebody cared. And that you don't get in many police departments.
We're speaking with Judy Muller, author of Emus, Loose, and Egnar. My name's Stephen Lyons. You're listening to Focus 580. Obituaries, they contain some of the best writing, I think, in these newspapers, and inconsistently, but there are some wonderful, especially if the family members are very much involved. And how are they handled in a small town weekly?
Well, the things that are celebrated in a small town obituary are very different than something you'd see in the New York Times. First of all, you wouldn't get an obit in the New York Times unless you were famous and had done a number of things. In a small town, the thing that makes you celebrated is the kind of neighbor you are, the kind of person you were. And I remember seeing, and I've got it in my book, in Norwood, in my paper, the Norwood Post, and this was a big obituary because this is a person who's very popular, this Doris Ruff, as local as they come, dies at 76. Mm. And that was the headline, as local as they come is a high compliment. She is forever revered here. The best of what this county can produce, her work ethic, her charm, her ability to do everything at once. I mean, you know, and then it's kind of buried. She never married and was quiet socially. How can I say this, said a friend, Doris never married. I always felt she was lonely. She cared a lot about people. You know, I mean, you get this picture of somebody who may have been lonely, but by God, she was out there every day helping her neighbors. And I don't know. I don't know that there's anything you could say better about a person at the end of their life, really.
I want to switch gears in the remaining time we have. Talk a little bit about the future of journalism education, where it's at right now, since you're on the faculty at USC, Annenberg School of Communication. And I received something in the mail, the Carnegie Knight Initiative on the Future of Journalism Education. And your university's mentioned in it.
Mm-hmm.
Your dean says there's a proposal that your mission at the School of Journalism to prepare current and future journalists to bring a critical eye, a passion for public service, a mastery of both verbal and visual language to their work in order to reveal the truth about important issues of today and to help drive social and institutional change in a society that is increasingly alienated from institutions and skeptical of their messages. When I think of that and think of your book, Emus, Luce, and Egnar, and the wonderful reporting and writing and passion that goes on in small-town weeklies, how do you get 20-something-year-old students who grew up in a digital world that may not open any newspapers except on their iPad, how do you get them excited about a newsroom, the smell of newsprint?
Well, you don't.
Okay. There you go.
First of all,
how does it translate the digital into print, or does it not?
Well, I think that the basics of journalism, the excitement about the story and getting and being a witness to history and all the things that do give you a passion for journalism, and some students come and they discover that's really not their thing and they, you know, don't pursue it, which is fine. That's part of what college is about. You know, if you find out that this isn't for you, that's fine. But the ones who stick with it, it doesn't matter what the medium is. It doesn't matter if it's newsprint or digital or, you know, some chip in their head. I mean, I don't know what we're going to have in 10 years from now. The point is that they get hooked on telling that story in a way that makes a difference, that informs people, that changes people, that moves people. And when they see that, when they put that out and it comes back to them, that people say, Oh, I saw that story and I was crying. Oh, those poor people. I really related. I mean, it just takes once, and they are sold. And it doesn't matter whether it's online or in print or on television or my love, which is radio.
Can you really teach this, or is this innate? Or
boy,
mean, this excitement you're talking about, because, boy, we need it. We need it so bad.
I don't know that you can teach it. I know that I can tap into people who have it. This is a question that we ask ourselves a lot, you know, on the faculty, is, you know, when we're trying to teach them how to pitch stories and know what a good story is, some people really get it. They are innately curious and they see things that need further investigation. Sometimes when I get a class, will say, I don't know where to find a good story, you know, and thinking, my gosh, do you have a pulse? So what I do is I send them out the door and I say, you have 1 hour. It's a scavenger hunt. Come back here in 1 hour with a good story. Talk to people, find out a good story. And it unnerves them. You know, they go, oh, my gosh, how will I do this? And they come back with the best stuff. You know, so sometimes it's just a matter of getting them out of their little shell and getting them out into the world.
Do the students know our rich history of journalism in this country? When they come to you, when they're coming into the freshman year of journalism at USC, do they have a sense, have they read enough about the Tom Gishes of the world?
No, but that's our job.
Okay.
You know, that's our job.
Mm-hmm. And what am I trying to ask here? I understand what you're saying, that it doesn't matter where the journalism ends up, whether it's digital or print. But is there a curiosity about working at newspapers?
I don't know. I mean, I think what we've got here is we used to have, you know, especially in the graduate program and in the undergrad too, they had to declare whether they were a print journalism major, a broadcast journalism major, and online. We're getting rid of those. Everybody's online. Mm-hmm. Everybody's everything. So our print students have to learn how to shoot and edit and do radio as well, because that's where it's going. Everybody has to be able to write in text. We call it text now, not print, which I hate, but it's text. You have to learn how to write a long article as well as a very pithy broadcast lead and what the difference is. This is a huge, tall order, and quite frankly, I'm glad I was in broadcasting before all of this was required, but it is, they have to do everything.
Do you need a journalism degree?
Yeah. Well, I used to think you didn't. When people would say, should I go to journalism school? I'd say, oh, no, just go out and start doing it. But I've changed my mind about that because there is so much required now, so many new skills, and there's no more on-the-job training in a newsroom. They don't have time for that. So it's better to come and get those, just the basic skills, so that when you get thrown into the newsroom, you've already got that step up.
Are there jobs?
You know, there are jobs. It's amazing because at least my television students and my radio students are getting jobs. I can point to like six radio students who have gone on to be at Marketplace, some of them on the air, some as producers, and at local NPR stations around the country. Actually, I encourage everybody to go into radio journalism because not only is it my favorite medium, but as David Folkenflik at NPR's media guy points out, it is, ironically, the one platform that's going to outlast everybody because it's the only one you can take in the news without, you could carry it with you in a podcast or whatever form, but you don't have to watch it at the same time. So you can walk, and you can be totally mobile, and you can get all your information. And I thought that was a great pitch for radio.
What do you think of citizen journalism? Right now we have this Occupy Wall Street event, which is huge, going on in New York City and now spreading, I believe, to Pittsburgh and other places quickly, it seems. And yet the mainstream media at first didn't quite catch on to it.
No, they didn't. They were scared of it. The gatekeepers especially like to be gatekeepers. You know, in the days when the old white wise fathers in New York and Washington told us what we should know, that's over those days. I mean, I think we embrace that. At the same time, I'm about to teach a course here next semester, which I think is very important, and I'm in part of this movement. It's called News Literacy, and this is for the non-journalist. This is for all those people out there, the citizen journalists, the consumers. How do you tell what's credible and what's not? What's the difference? What's the difference between evidence and assumption? So I'm going to be teaching a course that aims to educate the audience because I think that's the next step.
That sounds great. Well, we've just had a delightful conversation. I'm so thankful to talk with Judy Muller, author of Emus, Loose, and Eggnar from University of Nebraska Press. And Judy, it's just a fascinating read, and I wish you best of luck. And I look forward to hearing you on the airwaves and seeing you on the big screen.
Thank you so much. This is a delight.
Thanks, Judy. Event, which is huge, going on in New York City and now spreading, I believe, to Pittsburgh and other places quickly, it seems. And yet the mainstream media at first didn't quite catch on to it.
No, they didn't. They were scared of it. The gatekeepers especially like to be gatekeepers. You know, in the days when the old white wise fathers in New York and Washington told us what we should know, that's over those days. I mean, I think we embrace that. At the same time, I'm about to teach a course here next semester, which I think is very important, and I'm in part of this movement. It's called News Literacy, and this is for the non-journalist. This is for all those people out there, the citizen journalists, the consumers. How do you tell what's credible and what's not? What's the difference? What's the difference between evidence and assumption? So I'm going to be teaching a course that aims to educate the audience because I think that's the next step.
That sounds great. Well, we've just had a delightful conversation. I'm so thankful to talk with Judy Muller, author of Emus, Loose, and Eggnar from University of Nebraska Press. And Judy, it's just a fascinating read, and I wish you best of luck. And I look forward to hearing you on the airwaves and seeing you on the big screen.
Thank you so much. This is a delight.
Thanks, Judy. And thank you very much for listening, everybody. That's Focus 580 for the day. Please stay tuned for Afternoon Magazine.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, and thousands of accessories at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
And at 2 minutes before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert, your host for the Afternoon Magazine, with a look at numbers at the midday. On the markets in Kansas City, hard red winter wheat for December, 701 down 3 for March, 716 and a half down 2 and a quarter. In Chicago, the December wheat at 6.18 and a half up 9, March, 654 and a half, that's up 8. December corn, 596 and a half up 4, March, 610 down, up rather 4 and a quarter, May, 618 up 4 and a half. November crude oil, 78.73, that's down 40, 45. November beans, 1187 and three quarters, up 8 3/4. January, 1198 and three quarters, up 9 1/4. March, 1207 and three quarters, up 9 1/2. October soybean meal, 308.60, up 390. In December, 313.40, up, that's up 480. October soybean oil, 49.64, that's down 31 cents. October live cattle, 122.30, that's up one, it's up 15. October feeder cattle, 141.55, that's up 102.5. October lean hogs, 92.80, that's down 50, that's down 57.5. On December, 87.45, down 35. At this hour, the Arbonne gasoline, 252.50. That's down one. That's down 31. Around 131. Dow Jones 10.836. That's down 77 points. And the S&P 11.20. That's down 11. Forecast for us today in Champaign-Urbana, sunny skies, a high of 73 degrees. Clear tonight. The low 42. For tomorrow, the high 75 with sunny skies. Mostly clear tomorrow night, the low 48 degrees. Right now, 71 on French Plaza in Urbana. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. It's coming up on 12 noon. Stay tuned for NPR.